Welcome. My name is Kate Lutzner. I'm a poet, and I'm going to introduce the speakers. Our moderator for today is writer Kristen Rupeniam. She's best known for her 2017 viral short story, Cat Person, and her 2019 short story collection, You Know You Want This. Cat Person remains one of the most widely read stories published by The New Yorker and was released in theaters as a feature film in 2023. Currently, she is working on a novel. Please help us welcome Kristen. Co-author Kusala Bhikshu is joining us from Los Angeles via Zoom and was ordained in the Mahayana Buddhist tradition in 1994. He is the head monk at the International Buddhist Meditation Center in Koreatown, Los Angeles. The book Urban Dharma is based on his 20 years of service work as a chaplain in prisons, juvenile halls, hospitals, and the police department. When not giving public talks, you can usually find Kusala caring for the 12 plus homeless cats that live at the meditation center. Welcome, Kusala. Co-author Rebecca Wilson has been producing multi-format media for over 20 years. She has been a staff producer for TED Talks, the Dalai Lama's Cultural Center in NYC, Dr. Robert Thurman, the Siddhartha School Partnership, and more. Currently based in Brooklyn, New York, she shares her apartment with 1.5 plants. Please welcome Rebecca.
I'm so glad that you all joined us today. I'm really excited to be here with Rebecca and Kusala to talk about their book, Urban Dharma. Before we get started, just a couple orders of business. First, we're thinking of this as an interactive event. We'd love to get your questions, both people in the audience in person and also over Zoom. So as we start, I'll ask some questions, but keep thinking of your own, and we'll bring you in around 7:15 or so. Books for sale right over there if you don't have a copy already. We'll be selling them after everybody.
Yeah, hey everybody. Hey. Yeah, okay, audio. There we go. Hi. Hi everybody. Hi. You hear me? Hi Kusala.
I can hear you.
Good. Yeah, can you hear me? Okay.
I can hear you too. Much better.
Great. All right, so I'm excited to talk about the book, but first, just kind of by way of introduction, I was wondering if each of you, Rebecca and Kusala, could tell us a little bit about your path to Buddhism, how you got here, and if there were any books that were important to you along the way. Rebecca, do you want to get us started?
Sure. First, thank you to Shanti Deva, who is hosting the event. You guys have been wonderful to have us here. Super grateful. I found Buddhism, I write about it a little bit in the foreword. A lot of anxiety, and when I say anxiety, it means more like existential crisis type anxiety of like, what are we doing here? What is going on? Why do I feel this way? So my friend Kate took me to a meditation that was in the Zen tradition. And so I started going to that weekly and studying Zen, but I really wasn't that interested in the teachings. I was more interested in meditation. And then I happened to meet the Dalai Lama, and then I met a monk. I know, it was just so happened through this professional thing that I didn't even want to be at, right? I didn't even want to go to it. And I was like, it's the Dalai Lama. And so, you know, because I was working for rock stars at the time, and I met him, and it was like blew my socks off. It was just being in his presence. There was something there. And I met a monk that day and started studying with him. And I met Kusala, I don't know, 7 or 8 years later.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. And Kusala, do you want to give us a brief introduction, say hello, and any books that have been really meaningful to you as you came to Buddhism?
Yeah, you know, I found Buddhism in like 1979, 1980. As I was getting close to turning 30, I knew I'd be dead soon because people over 30 died quickly. And I bought this book by Houston Smith called World Religions. And in that book, there was a chapter on Buddhism. And I said, yeah, that's what I want to be. I was non-religious up to that point. And I figured if I got a religion, I could die better than not having a religion. And so the next book I got was the phone book and the yellow pages when they still had yellow pages. and found the meditation center where I live. And then my first teacher was Shinzen Young. He was a Jewish guy from LA who went to Japan to study Japanese and became ordained as a Shingon monk. And he was living at the center when I started to meditate. And so he was my introduction. I was able to see this sort of like Caucasian guy who was a Buddhist monk. And I thought, cool, I guess everybody can be a Buddhist, you know? And I think the most important book I read about Buddhism was the Dhammapada. That was the first book I read, and it was meaningful to me.
Wonderful. Thank you both so much. So you said you had been studying Buddhism for about 7 years when you met Kusla. And when did the idea of writing a book about his life first occur to you?
That's a good question. I know.
It's all her fault. It's all her fault, you know.
It's all my fault. It always is. I think... I was at an existential crisis in LA. I'd moved there always, you know, and being like, WTF. And so I overheard him talking about his community service, and I had no work, so I have always generated my own creative work in a way that was hands in the dark, like just go for it, right? Everything I've ever done, I just go for it. So I just went to him and I said, hey, that sounds like a good book. And and he said, well, someone tried to translate my talks once, but we just got a transcript, and it didn't translate to a literary form. And so we just did one recording, and I wrote one chapter, and we were off, and that was it. It was just funny.
And Kusla, what did you think when Rebecca first approached you with that idea? Were you taken aback, or did you thought, oh, perfect?
Well, my first thought was she's out of work and needs to do something. And there I was, you know, and I didn't think, you know, I had much to offer, because most Buddhist books are about Buddhism and how to be a Buddhist. And what does it all mean? And she was never impressed with my Buddhism. but then I started to talk about my volunteer work. And she said, now that might make a book.
Hold on just a second. Yeah. We're losing your audio. Just a second, Kusla.
Okay.
Yeah. I think it might be, let's just try
it.
Yeah, we can hear you now.
Okay. So I'll talk loud so you can hear me all the way in New York.
And, thank you.
And so, you know, we decided to meet on the porch of Kuan Yin, which is one of the houses at our center. And we just had these discussions. We would talk back and forth, and she'd record, and then she'd write, and then we'd talk again. And it was just sort of a conversational sharing of information. And that's how it all started. But that was like 9 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so in the course of 9 years, like everything changes. But the book kept, you know, materializing page by page, paragraph by paragraph. And it was more than I expected. I didn't expect much because it was my story, and I was sort of used to it. But Rebecca was able to find a way to make it interesting in a literary form. You know, as I talk about it, I always felt my talk was much more interesting than my writing. And she was able to translate that onto page.
Yeah, one of the things I really was struck by reading the book is how lively it is, how it really does capture the spirit of a conversation, even as it has a literary form. You can feel that energy. And I actually think that's a really great transition. Rebecca, if you wanted to read a passage or two from the book,
yeah,
so people
sure.
can have a taste of it.
So this is going to be about 5 minutes, but I just picked one scenario. So Kusla did a lot of work all throughout many community institutions in Los Angeles. This one is from his work as a police chaplain, which meant that he went through target training. He learned how to fire a gun. He got fitted for a bulletproof vest. He also had to go to the coroners and see dead bodies with all the other, this is all in the book, with all the other chaplains, which were from a variety of traditions, from Christianity to Muslim to Jewish. And he was always the only Buddhist one. He always jokes. There was always a joke that he was the second, but he never found out who the first was. And he was always asking, who was the first Buddhist chaplain? So anyways, this is his first ride-along. And we pick up a lot of these cops, they didn't know that he was going to be with them. So a lot of times he'd show up and be assigned to a squad car, and they would be a little disgruntled or not sure. You know, he was a liability, and nobody told them about him. So anyhow, but this, we're just picking up after they've been in the car a little while, and they're rolling up to like a police, a domestic disturbance. As we rounded the corner, the block near our destination, he shut off the sirens and lights, and I quietly coasted to a stop in front. The home was an average 1970s tan stucco with a gravel yard. "Should I stay here?" I asked, feeling a sudden nervous heat under my vest. I never imagined the moment I'd arrive on the police scene wearing a bulletproof vest with only about 43 hours of proxy training. "Kind of defeats the purpose, wouldn't it?" he said. I fell in behind him as we walked up the sidewalk. We stood at the door and took a beat, listening. Then he reached up and gave that perfect cop door knock, quick, measured, and it meant business. Inside, a woman erupted in Vietnamese. I couldn't understand a word of it, but I didn't need to. Her suffering was obvious. A tall, lanky man matter-of-factly answered the door. He acted as if we were selling Girl Scout cookies. "Hello," he said with a smile. "Sir, we've received a..." The screaming erupted again. It was coming from the back of the house. "Sir, what's going on?" The man's posture collapsed as he rubbed one eye. "Everything's fine. It's my wife. We're just fighting." The man didn't move. "Any physical altercations tonight?" "No." "Well, someone called, and that's why we're here. Can we come in?" Worry washed through his eyes. It's routine that we look around and make sure that everyone's all right. The woman started up again, and whatever she was shouting, it was the same thing repeatedly, except now she had tears in her voice. The man erupted, "Shut up, it's the police." She fell silent. None of us moved. An invisible thread of pause connected us all. "Sir, can she come to the door?" "No, she's drunk." He rubbed his eyes again. The officer stepped into the doorframe. The man exhaled, tired and defeated, and stepped aside, letting the front door swing wide. "You can come in, but she's really drunk." Two Asian silk paintings hung on the wall of the living room. A Jack in the Box commercial played on a muted TV. The big white bubblehead Jack drove the family along in the station wagon. "Usually she just passes out," the man said, "but she's had a lot of coffee today." "Ma'am," the officer called with the perfect blend of compassion and authority. "Ma'am, my name is Officer Devin, police. I'm here to check your welfare. Can you step out here for a second?" "Ma'am, if you don't come out here, I have to come back in there," said Officer Devin. The man looked away, his face souring. Officer Devin stood in the hallway looking at the closed door. The slit of light lined the bottom. "Okay, could you please just have a seat on the couch for us then?" The man did, and Officer Devin continued to walk down the hallway. We stood outside the door. "Ma'am, I'm a police officer and I'm coming in. I just need to confirm that you're not hurt." The silence bled out from under the door. "We're coming in now," Devin said, and he rested his hand on his gun and then turned the knob and pushed open the door. We both stood looking. Large shards of jagged glass. Oh, I missed a part. This is important. So before he goes down the hallway, the man says, "She threw an alarm clock at me," he blurted, "and a huge mirror on my door broke. That's probably why someone called you," he confessed. I had to go back for that, right? I had to go back. So we stood looking. Large shards of jagged glass stuck up like butterfly wings from the shag carpet. Tangled in the mess was a 1980s snooze bar alarm clock. The woman was in her 60s and was sitting on her bed. She stared vacantly in our direction but didn't seem to grasp that we were here. She had a slight sway of drunkenness. "Are you all right?" Devin asked. Her eyes were swollen, her cheeks were wet, but she wasn't crying now. "No," she said. "Are you hurt?" "Yes," she said. Officer Devin stepped into the glass and it crunched like grape nuts under his boots. "Where are you hurt, ma'am?" She pointed at her chest. "Sad," she said. "I noticed a small shrine set up in the table next to the closet. Lit with electric candles, various trinkets surrounded the picture of a youthful Vietnamese man." She looked at me and pointed to the glass on the floor. "Shoes," she said. I went to the front door where I'd seen the shoes and returned with a black pair of slippers. Looks like your foot's bleeding, Officer Devon said. I handed her the slippers, and her eyes awakened from their drunken haze, registering the kindness of a stranger.
Thank you so much. Kusla, I'm curious, from your perspective, what is it like to hear your story kind of shaped and read back to you like that? Does it change your perspective on any of the things that you remember?
Yeah, well, of course, it changes everything. We talked about this 9 years ago. And so every time I hear that story, I'm hearing it for the first time. And it's sort of fun that way.
Yeah.
It doesn't get old.
Are there anything, as you went back over those stories, were there things that, as you saw Rebecca shape them, seemed more important than they had at the time, or where you thought the lesson was one thing and then in conversation discovered that the takeaway was something different?
No, you know, I never looked at it as a lesson. I think that's probably, why it was difficult for me to think of it as being a book. And some of the things I think that are in the book, I'm not sure, but for instance, when the officer and I would go out for our lunch break or our dinner break, he would always sit against the wall looking at the door in case something went down. And he didn't like the idea of having the food cooked in the back. So we did a lot of buffets with pre-cooked food. So he could see, that it wasn't being tampered with. And those kind of things I thought were interesting because I hadn't thought about them before. And when I was in the police car doing the ride-alongs, nobody ever looked at us. We'd pull up to a stoplight and everybody would just look straight ahead, not to the left, not to the right. They didn't want to get caught for whatever reason, And so I thought that was sort of interesting that we became invisible in some cases or very visible in other cases and had to act a certain way. There's a certain protocol when you have your chaplain's uniform on or your police uniform on that people expect you to be a certain way. And that's what we tried to live up to. And of course, being the chaplain, it was kindness and compassion. Being the police officer, it was authority,
right.
Taking control, being in charge. And that wasn't my job. My job wasn't to be in charge.
No. Were there any moments when you were doing the police ride-alongs where you felt like those two roles were in contrast, where it was hard for you to decide what your job was when you were there in service of kindness and compassion when the police had to enforce authority?
Yeah, there was a situation that I thought was interesting. And because I was there, it changed the whole dynamic. That they were called to a porn shop because somebody was stealing pornography. And it turned out to be a guy who was married who lived in the next town over. And so everybody sort of became very righteous. And said, how could you do that when you have a wife? And da-da-da-da-da-da. And I'm thinking to myself, as this is all going on, it's only because I was there.
Right.
I was the religious, person. And they were assuming my standards were very high. So sometimes it happened that way. That because I was there, they did act differently.
That's fascinating. I loved all of the stories of the police ride-alongs, but I was also really struck by the sections set in the prison, especially because I felt like you were so honest both about the rewards and the challenges of it. And on page 86 or 87, Rebecca and I were talking about it, where it says that you had taken vows that state a commitment to return lifetime after lifetime to help all beings find their way out of suffering. And although it is a clear-cut case of the infinitely impossible, it somehow gives life purpose. And I thought, since this is a book so much about service work, and I think a lot of us probably do various forms of volunteering or trying to make the world a better place and then face burnout, it's interesting to think about volunteering from a Buddhist perspective, where the idea is that you're always there in the face of the infinitely impossible, as opposed to trying to serve a particular purpose, prison reform or police reform. And I was wondering if you just talk a little bit more about, I know you said the book isn't there to teach lessons, and I feel like there's absolutely nothing didactic about it, but for people who are curious about what it might mean to do service work from a particularly Buddhist informed perspective, what you noticed and what you might suggest to them.
Yeah, well, the first thing, you spoke about the Bodhisattva vows, that you know, as opposed to the Theravada tradition, if I can get Nirvana, I'm taking it. Because this is, I don't want to ever come back again. And the Mahayana are going, you know, the suffering beings are infinite. And we've chosen to look at Buddhism just a little differently. And I thought to myself, well, you know, it is sort of a, it does add purpose to your life and your many lives. And it gives you something to do. And people say, well, why would you want to do that in the first place? And in my case, all my experiences with volunteer work, I was invited. Yeah. I never walked up to the police department and said, hey, do you have any openings for a free chaplain? You know, I got, you know, the mayor contacted me when they're trying to diversify their police force and their chaplain program. Could I do that? And so I just kept answering the phone and accepting invitations. So I didn't have this giant purpose to save the world. I had a nice purpose to feed the cats. Yeah, that was doable every day. But to save the world, no. The world's always been messed up, and it always will be messed up forever and ever. And so people say, well, how can you not get depressed? Well, the idea is that it's never been different than this. And our job really isn't to save the world. Our job is to reduce suffering. So, you know, my job isn't to feed everybody, but to help the person I'm looking at if they're hungry. And that breaks it down into this sort of relative reality of, okay, I can handle that. But when I think about 8 billion people, there's just no way. I wouldn't come out of the meditation center. I just stay there forever and ever. A lot of people do. But once I got out into the world, I started to see that maybe just being there is enough. Mm-hmm. I didn't have any skills. I didn't go to school to learn how to be a volunteer. I just showed up and did the best that I could in every situation I found myself in. And in that case, yes, I did learn stuff. I learned mostly what not to do. And that was valuable because people keep asking you these questions that you can't answer. You know, why is life this way? And how can you answer that? You could say, well, it's karma, or it's because you live in Los Angeles, or it's because you're in California. You can do that kind of stuff, but that's not a real answer. So I would just most of the time listen to people, you know, and did I ever save anybody? Did I ever help anybody? I have no indication that I did. I just kept showing up and I'd put in my time and I'd leave. And then I'd go back. And the police department was 7 years. So now it's like 7 years and I'm thinking to myself, how long am I supposed to do this? How long does a volunteer?
Yeah.
Is 7 years good enough? I thought that might be good enough.
Yeah.
But then the phone rang again and somebody else said, hey, I heard about you. Would you be willing? And so the volunteer started again and again. So 20 plus years of volunteer work with no intention of ever doing it, but accepting invitations and seeing that maybe the difference is just being a kind person with a good ear and understanding the suffering that you're seeing in front of you. Yeah. And what I like to say about suffering is this, that I have never seen suffering. It has no color. It has no size. It has no sound. All I have ever seen are the results of suffering in the faces of people, in the behavior of people. So I've only seen the results. So people say, well, what does suffering look like? I have no idea, but I can tell you how people react to it. And it's not very pretty because they don't like it. So, you know, I learned a lot about suffering, and I'm able to sort of, in my own suffering that I go through, just being a human being, I'm able to apply some of that to myself as well. And so the journey of ultimately was not to help people, but to heal myself in a really sort of spiritual way, which is odd, because that was not my intention. I thought I was fine.
But
then I realized, no, I'm like everybody else.
That is so lovely to hear, and I think really helpful to me when I think about going out in the world and putting down that idea that I can or have to make it better. You sort of touched on it, and one of the things I liked in a lot of the stories was how you were encountering so many people with such a wide idea of what Buddhism was, what a Buddhist mm-hmm. should do, and what you were there to accomplish. And I'm curious if there were any questions that people asked you about Buddhism that really stumped you or stuck in your mind as you were talking to people. Were there any questions that you really didn't know how to answer?
You know, probably, but I can't recall any. I'm actually gifted with the gift of gab.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I generally talk about myself and how I see Buddhism.
Yeah.
I'm not a scholar, so I don't go in that direction. I can appreciate scholars, and I like to listen to them occasionally, but basically they're talking to four people. Mm-hmm. You know, the four people that actually understand what they're saying.
Yeah.
And so I always felt it better to talk to the heart. Yeah. And so my answers were generated from just my experience of life and my understanding of Buddhism, which is constantly evolving into something else. You know, I mean, you start with the Dhammapada, and then you go here, and then you go there, and then you like Theravada, and then you really like Zen for a while. You know, and then Vajrayana is sort of cool because it's got all the bells and whistles. And you just go through all this stuff, you know, and so what does it all mean? I suppose it means that ultimately you find a place of peace in the chaos because of all of that Buddhism stuff.
That sounds pretty nice. Becca. This book was 9 years in the making. Can you talk a little bit about how the process of writing it changed you or shifted your perspective on your practice?
Yeah, I think, Kusala, you really talked about it. I would write up the whole bones of the story and then go to him with the wisdom parts. Like, what do we do? What do we put in for the wisdom parts? Because he's a monk. And so... I thought it was going to be some big reveal, right, about answers, but he really just touched on it. It's about showing up. And so I learned a lot about that in myself. When you're in a hopeless room, like with somebody who is dying of cancer, with somebody who has no future due to mental illness or a variety of reasons, how do you stay grounded? And what you don't do, you just... be there, like what he talked about, and you try. For me, that's what changed me, mm-hmm. you know, and I think that was a huge, I was always looking for the pot of gold answer, and there just isn't for me, and I kind of learned that through you, Kusala, like just exactly what you just said, you know, mm-hmm. so that's what I would say.
As you guys were putting together the book and deciding how to choose from, you know, it sounds years and years worth of stories, were there any guidelines where you thought we definitely want to talk about this or we absolutely shouldn't include this? Or are there any outtakes that didn't get included in the book for any reason? Can you give us some behind the scenes details?
I feel like everything was so unplanned. You know, I mean, we never planned anything. We just met and showed up, like what we were just talking about. And I think The only thing that Kusala actually informed, which was super important, is that his voice on stage, because he's got a lot of media out there, is very simplistic, as you've heard. And I always appreciated that. And so are the writing. We made sure not to use large words. We didn't want it to seem grandiose. It's very basic. So I think that was a huge carving out that we did vocabulary-wise and tone-wise. But Kusala, what do you think too?
Well, I remember talking with you, Rebecca, about the problem of naming names and places. That, you know, lawsuits are everywhere. And so we needed to be careful in our situational storytelling and not bring in people who may not want to be there or were surprised that we'd be in the book. So there are names, there are real names in the book, but those people knew they were going to be in it. And there are names that aren't in the book because those people didn't know they were going to be in it. And so I felt much more comfortable with that. I know, you know, in LA too, just like New York, you know, every time you mention somebody's name who's a celebrity or a star of some kind, man, the lawyers just line up, you know? So we didn't want that. We wanted it to be more heartfelt than celebrity oriented. And so sometimes the situations, you know, it wasn't in this hospital, it was in a different hospital, but we didn't name that hospital. And that doesn't interfere with the story. That just allows us to be more comfortable in the way we express the story.
Did you have a particular person in mind? When I'm writing, I'm always secretly imagining how one person is going to react to it, or trying to figure out, you know, who my dream audience is. Did you either consciously or maybe subconsciously have one person that you were picking, that you were thinking about reading this book and wondering how they would respond?
I didn't think anybody was going to read the book.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I never thought about it once. I was just trying to get through it and see how, it was a real process, but I don't know. Kusala, I don't know if you had anyone. I felt like you probably didn't either.
No, I knew I was going to read it. So at least one person was going to read it. But I didn't think of an audience. I did think of the audience we weren't going to get.
Okay.
And that was the scholarship audience. That was the audience who would buy a book and say, well, what are the 10 ways that Buddhists are Buddhists? You know, and I didn't want to write that kind of book. And of course we didn't. So we wrote about not so much being a Buddhist, but doing Buddhism, which is a subtle difference. And I like that. But then how do you figure out who your audience is? You know, because the Buddhist, if you go to Amazon.com and put in Buddhism, there's like 5,000 books, you know, and even if you put Buddhist memoirs, then there's only 3,000 books. And you're just going, wow, you know, with all those other books out there, is anybody going to find this little guy? Mm-hmm. And ironically and surprisingly, yes, there are people who are finding this book. And all of them say, which I really think is a very nice compliment to Rebecca, it's an easy read. Rebecca at one point said, you think we should put a vocabulary section in there, you know, so people would know what we're talking about. I said, no, it's okay. We're not using that many words that people aren't going to know. And they can look it up on Google if they're really curious. You know, so it was wonderful in that way, that it just sort of naturally unfolded. And when I talked to Rebecca about her process, she said it was more of an intuitive process than an intellectual process. And that's what I feel in the book. It's we're going in a direction that's more heart than mind. And yet people feel it in so many different ways. And I like that idea. And I don't think most Buddhist books that deal with the intricacies of Buddhism, you know, are designed to do that.
Yeah, I completely agree. I've read a fair amount, not nearly as many as probably both of you, but books about Buddhism. And I would say what distinguishes it is not that its vocabulary is simple, which is not something I would have noticed, but that it's so concrete. Like, something is always happening. And I think that's what you mean by doing Buddhism. And it really does illuminate how easy it is to slide into abstraction and to think about things and how different it is to illustrate it by what's happened. And I think that is really, like you said, a testament to Rebecca and your writing and the way of approaching the material. There's no dead air because something is always taking place on the page. Did that take a lot of revision to get to, or was it a part more of the process of writing the book for you?
No, I think I had a really good editor. Like, that helped a lot, yeah. To be honest. Yeah, I think that was really, the flow happened in the edit,
yeah.
with the outside person after the 9 years. Like, it was just too close, you know? And so when I finally implored somebody that was recommended to me, it really made everything click. Mm-hmm. I think that's
so worth taking the time.
Yeah, worth the money.
Yeah.
You know, and also I think the idea of thinking rather than doing. A lot of people think that thinking is enough.
Right.
I'm a good Buddhist because I think like a Buddhist, you know, and that may be true, but the good Buddhists I've seen are also doing something. Something that's kind and generous, you know, something that makes a difference, even a small difference. Like picking up trash that somebody just threw out of the car and just putting it in a container. Little stuff like that. That's what Buddhism instilled in me. It's not the big stuff that people go, wow. It's the little stuff that you do every day that nobody ever sees. I was talking the other day about making a difference in the world, and I said that when I first started practicing Buddhism, what I would do is I would leave change behind in the change slot of vending machines. And that was my way of practicing generosity, because I didn't know who was going to take it or how much or what they were going to do with it. And it was only a quarter or 10 cents or 5 cents. So I came up with the idea, changing the world one vending machine at a time. As you go through life, you know?
Is that the title of the sequel that you two are working on?
You know what? People are asking for sequels. That blows my mind.
Yeah.
Because I was surprised anybody still reads, yeah. You know, with all the streaming media that we have. But people are saying, you need to do a sequel.
Yeah.
And I hate to even suggest that to Rebecca after 9 years, you know? She'll be 80 by the time the sequel comes out.
Yeah. What do you think about that, Rebecca?
A sequel, maybe. I'd like to do one of my own novels, but then implore Kusala to be part of it too.
Right, Kusala, you can write Rebecca's life.
Yeah,
now.
There you go. Oh.
I'd be glad to talk about her life, but I don't think I could write her life.
No, I want to make sure we have time to hand it over to audience questions, but I just wanted to make sure before I turned it over, if there was anything you wanted to leave people with, like hopes you have for the book, when you put it out into the world, any lessons that you wanted to say people take away?
I think more along the lines of what Kusala said for me, Buddhism has given me a way to show up when I don't want to. You know, because it's so easy to help when it's easy, but to stand with the people that really turn the key inside me, you know, and crank me up and wind me up. And it really has given me, the teachings have really given me a way to think about them in a way that isn't self-reflective of what they're doing to me, but more about what they may be going through suffering-wise. So I would say that. Isn't an answer to your question, but it's what I just said. And I also would love to thank, I don't, is Lynn here? She designed the cover. There's a couple of people, no, she's not here, I guess. Shanti Deva, thank you. Kristen, thank you for moderating this too. And you know, my partner Pascal in the back, you've really been there for a year, like watching me trying to get it out through like editors that didn't work and designs that didn't work and, you know, existential crisis, of course.
Yeah.
And I just want to thank you guys all for being here, truly. I mean, and Lou online is, if you guys have questions online for the Zoom audience, please ask them in the chat and Lou will be your voice. But I don't know if anybody has any questions. I think that's all I have to say. Kusla, do you have anything that you want to say?
No, I'm just happy to be on Zoom.
Yeah.
I didn't have to fly to New York.
All right. Thank you, Kusla. Well, thanks, everybody. Thanks, you guys. Here, round of applause. So we have about 10 minutes for audience questions. And so that the people on Zoom can hear, we're going to pass around this mic. And also, the people on Zoom, you should feel free to ask questions. You can, I think, put them in the chat, and we'll make sure someone reads them out. So yeah, any questions for Rebecca?
Thank you so much. What a pleasure. I love this book. Let me just say that right now. I have two quick questions. First one, audiobook?
We wanted to, but we just wanted to get it out the door first.
Okay. It's been out the door for a month or so, right? It's time. Audiobook. Talk to me. I know somebody. And the second question I have that I just want to point out, you say you didn't have an audience, but in fact, the reader who is reading this book and learning how to do Buddhism is your audience, and they're people that maybe you're just introducing to the fact of it. I know I was, so thanks.
Hi, Rebecca, I'm so proud of you. And Kusala, I just had a question for you. When you were naming your favorite book about Buddhism, could you just tell me what that was again, because I wanted to write it down?
Yeah, I don't have necessarily a favorite book, but the first book I read on Buddhism was the Dhammapada, which is a classic Theravada text. The teachings of the Buddha, or the sayings of the Buddha. And I found that very useful, not knowing anything about Buddhism. I could understand that for some reason. And every time I read parts of the Bible, I could never understand any of it. So I assume that, you know, sort of drove me to feeling comfortable with Buddhism.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to meet you. And Rebecca, I'm really proud of you, and thank you.
Lou, are there any questions online or no?
No questions from the audience yet.
Okay.
So it took you 9 years to do this. Thank you for being persistent and not giving up, because we really, really love this book. Kusala, what in the meantime, what has been keeping you busy other than the cats?
In the meantime, what?
What has been keeping you busy other than the cats?
Okay. Yeah, the cats are my daily practice. I feed them twice a day. But what keeps me busy is my social media. I'm up at 4:35 every morning posting on Facebook. and that's become sort of my primary practice in the morning. And in LA, 4:35 in the morning is the best time to be awake, because it's before most people do wake up, and it's almost quiet. And then I've got a YouTube channel, and I have my Apple podcast, and I have all that kind of stuff. And what I really like about that is I don't have to go anywhere. I can sit here, and I don't have to smell good. I don't have to look good. And I can just come in contact with thousands and thousands of people, you know, and post a picture that's 10 years old and look really nice. And so it works out well. So the social media is what keeps me busy most of the time. But ironically, I still get the occasional call, hey, can you come and talk to our church? And I've got an upcoming talk at a Unitarian church here in Los Angeles. And so that's always exciting to finally get back into the world and give a presentation, because I like being a presenter. I still have stuff to say. And people seem to be interested in what I say and how I say it. And for the most part, they like my sense of humor as well. So for me, it's a win-win. I haven't gone to the open mics yet, but maybe one day that'll be next.
Bring your harmonica.
Yes, the harmonica.
I have a question for Kusala. I read the book. I loved it. I'm very interested in how you, as for your teachings and your, I work in healthcare, and I was really moved by a lot of the stories that you were able to just be with people. But one of the things that really, rejection isn't the right word, but when you, there was a woman who was dying and she asked you to, and then, but you seemed to like, well, I don't know exactly how you feel because it's a book and I'm sure there were other feelings around it, but you seem to move on and do the next thing. And how do you do that on a daily basis?
Yeah, moving on to the next thing. Yeah, that's always difficult because we have to let go. And so the woman that we're talking about in the book, you know, there was one point where, you know, I was asked to, you know, give my opinion and back up the family and all that kind of stuff. And I'm not a trained medical professional. So the doctors and nurses need to do that. I'm just there to give somebody a chance to talk and maybe talk about suffering and maybe figure out how you can suffer less. And so sometimes you just have to let go and go to the next thing. And there's always another patient, always another person that needs some assistance. And it can be difficult for the heart. Not so much the mind, because you can intellectualize why it's important to leave, but it pulls on the heartstrings a bit. And I didn't like that at first, because I didn't want to feel anything. But then I realized that my job is to feel something. It's not to go in there and be indifferent. It's to go in there and have equanimity, the balance of mind. And so that was a real big teaching for me. Another teaching was the woman who was dying, and her mother was living in the room with her while she was dying. I think she was 24 or something. What blew my mind was every time I walked in that room, I was in this giant present moment with no past or future. And I had read for years in all these Buddhist books, "Be here now," Ram Dass would repeat over and over again. But when you're in the now and there's no past or future, it is very difficult because we're so used to projecting into the past or into the future. And so when I would leave the room and go out to have lunch, it was like a breath of fresh air. It was like, wow, I still have a future. I still have a future. And I remember when my mother was dying, she was 84, and she said, one of the hardest things to deal with is not having a future. And I said, yeah, Mom, I know. But so those are a couple things that came to mind as that question was asked.
Really powerful, thank you. We have time for one or two more questions, if anybody has one.
What does Kusala mean, and is that your birth name? And if it isn't, how did you choose that name? How did you come to be called Kusala?
Yes, good question. Some people think I'm Scandinavian because of the name Kusala, but when I took my precepts, my five precepts as an official Buddhist, and got my certificate of authenticity, I was given a Buddhist name, and the Buddhist name was Kusala. Now, Kusala means skillful or wholesome, and Akusala means unskillful or unwholesome. So if someone has a speech impediment and goes, Akusala, I always sort of smile. But my teacher at that time, who was Shinzen, who gave me the name, he said, you know, we're giving you this name, Kusala, because you aren't skillful. And every time somebody says Kusala to you, it's to remind you what you need to be. So that's how I got the name.
Yeah. That's amazing. Thank you. Any other hands? Or I don't want to neglect Zoom if there's anybody.
I do have one question from Zoom. It's coming from A. Dudley. They say, love this book, Kusala. As someone who struggles a tad with public speaking, can you talk a little bit about grokking? I assume they mean growing?
Yeah, grokking, yeah.
What is that?
Okay, does everybody know what grokking is? Stranger from a Strange Land. Robert Heinlein. Michael Smith, I think his name was. So grokking means to intuitively take in everything at once. instead of intellectually dissecting and looking at pieces and then putting them together. So public speaking ultimately is about grokking the audience. And the audience just sends these vibes to you. And then you can accept them or reject them. But there's this little dance that happens as the audience continues to listen and encourage. Now, one of the techniques that I use in my public speaking is I have a rather odd sense of humor. And it's paradoxical because life is paradoxical. And I see these things and I try to interpret them, and they often end up in my presentations. And sometimes there'll be little chuckles, and sometimes there'll be actual laughter. And what's that telling me? It's telling me that everybody is still listening because they're laughing. So public speaking is really this sort of interaction, and they have become you, and you have become them, and that's what grokking is all about. And I had no idea when I read the book back in the 70s what it was about, but now it's making more and more sense, and it seems to be very Buddhist. And if you read any of Robert Heinlein's books, he oftentimes talks about cats as well. And I thought, maybe that's why I'm stuck with cats now. I just posted something today. A man said to the universe, "I do exist. I do exist." And the universe said, "I'm glad to hear that. I've got some cats that need to be looked after." And I'm going, there you go. That's what you get for existing.
I could talk about Buddhism, science fiction, and cats all day long, but that is pretty much our time. So I just want to have another round of applause for Kusala.